Greetings, every soul. This is Christopher Rudy for Cosmic Love, and today I'll be interviewing Lynn McTaggart, who is one of the preeminent spokespersons on consciousness, the new physics, and the science of spirituality. She is the award-winning author of 6 books, including The Intention Experiment, which has been published in 18 languages. Lynn is also co-executive director of 2 publishing companies, which publish some of the world's most respected health and spiritual newsletters, including What Doctors Don't Tell You and The Living Field. One of her best-selling books is called The Field, and today we'll be discussing her new book called The Bond, Connecting Through the Space Between Us. Regarding The Bond, Deepak Chopra said that once in a very great while, a book comes along that shifts our sense of reality or extols a new way of living. And Lynn McTaggart's extraordinary new book, The Bond, does both. Another one of my favorite authors, Marianne Williamson, said that there is something on every page of this book to make you jump for joy. It's like things you've secretly suspected but figured must not be true since no one else seems to think they are, but suddenly are proven to be true. You don't even realize how thirsty your soul has been for another way of looking at the world until it's given to you, and you can't stop drinking it. Rarely does a book so tell it like it is. So it's my great pleasure today to have Lynn McTaggart on Cosmic Love. Lynn, thank you for being with us.
It's so great to be with you today.
I'm really amazed at this book, your other work, and I know it's been quite a publishing journey from the Intention Experiment to The Field and now The Bond. So what do you find most interesting in the discoveries you've been making?
Well, I guess what's most interesting to me, Chris, is that things are a lot different from what we've been told. I think what's always fascinating for me is to show that the science is now catching up to the spiritual dimension, and that the things that are being discovered by cutting-edge physicists, biologists, psychologists, anthropologists, all the ologists, are finding that, you know, we're a lot less individual than we thought we were, but that between everything from the smallest subatomic particles to our giant societal structures, there's a bond. And by bond, I mean a connection so profound and integral that it's impossible to say where one thing ends and another thing begins. So I think for me, the fascinating thing is we've been told and we've been encouraged, and our societal structures are based on the idea that we're all individual and that we're also at the heart of ourselves competitive. And the science shows emphatically that's not the case, that we actually, nature's greatest drive is toward wholeness, and that we succeed when we share, care, and are fair, and not when we compete. And that's probably the biggest reason we're in such crisis today.
And this process of awakening to this understanding, I would believe that this is going to be the resolution of the problem. And what do you see the prospects for where things are going now?
Well, we're at a real fork in the road, aren't we? We have one particular trajectory, which says let's continue the path that we're on right now, which is a path toward, as I call it, greater atomization. You know, it's toward the idea that we continue to follow the individualist path and the competitive model, and we see what's left and we take it for ourselves, you know, and it's like we're here with our gun, you know, protecting what's ours. So that's one scenario. And of course, you know, in my view, that scenario will lead to something that's very similar to what Cormac McCarthy wrote in The Road, you know, of all of us, you know, fighting for what's ours with our gun, and there being less and less to go around, and there, you know, we being, you know, one pitted against the other. Or we can follow the other route, which is to embrace who we really are, our sense of wholeness, to recreate our societal structures to honor holism and cooperation and connection and community, rather than extreme competitive individualism. And that is the route, I think, to our salvation.
Well, there's a huge drama unfolding right now, and it's kind of timely with our talk, bringing in this subject. There's a lot of buzz out there about 11-11-11, and there's just a lot of a demonstration in the streets that there's got to be a better way, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's going global right now.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, the whole Occupy movement is a manifestation of what's wrong now in our society. And what's wrong essentially has to do with the very heart of the bond, which is the need we all have for fairness, the need we have for connection and cooperation. And that has, you know, slowly been eroded from modern society, you know, and all Western society particularly, and, you know, probably the apex of that is American society, because we have revered the idea of the lone wolf individual. You know, that's essential to our American culture. But, you know, when you look at it, the end stage of that mindset is exactly what we have now, which is huge corporate cheating, which is a whole financial model that's corrupt, which is enormous disparity and unfairness, which is what's happened now. You know, we've got the 1% that owns 40% of the money or controls it and controls more and more of the systems to make it impossible for the 99% to get by. So the 1% has infiltrated basically every aspect of society. And when the sad thing is, nobody wins, not even the 1%. I found the most amazing study the other day. It was looking at financial, at income levels compared to levels of trust and also levels of health. And it found that the richest people in every neighborhood were the most distrustful of their neighbors and also, and probably consequently, the least healthy. So even the people who have made it with the American dream are no better off. Their whole sense of trust in society and the glue, the bond that we all have is also eroded. So they may have achieved the American dream, but for them, it's the American nightmare. So, you know, what we find with when things are unfair, as I put it in the bond, everybody loses, rich and poor. I mean, they've found that the more unfair any society, and by unfair, I mean you don't get just desserts, just reward for just effort, but that if it's rigged somehow so that certain people get undue reward for little effort and at the expense of other people who, even despite a great deal of effort, do not get reward. That's what unfairness is. Situations are like that, everybody loses, rich and poor, in all of the major social indicators, whether it's mental health, regular health, crime and violence, education. And right now, you know, unfairness erodes everything. It undermines democracy, as one commentator put it. And that's really what we're seeing now. We're seeing a revolution in the start. You know, we're seeing conditions that were no different from the Arab nations. And we're now seeing a situation where people are saying, no, we're not going to take this anymore.
It's kind of like the on a global scale, it's really the energy of the American Revolution back at that time. And of course, we're seeing the Tea Party came out of that same, kind of co-opting the concept of the Tea Party, the Boston Tea Party, and the American Revolution, that concept. But now it's a global issue. It's interesting to me how the internet has already created an instant, everywhere, interactive global village. You know, we're all one in principle now. But
yes,
there's all these walls in the mind, and largely it's the walls between the left brain and the right brain in the global hemispheres, you know, the Western and the Eastern way of looking at things. And it's fascinating to me how we've come to this point where there's this urgent need to recognize, you know, this unity in our diversity, which is really the rallying cry of the American colonies. You know, either we all hang together or we're all going to hang separately.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and that's that is the interesting thing about this. We've sort of recognized, you know, the unity has come via the modern technology. But what we're really railing against is a huge lack of unity, a lack of trust, a lack of fairness, the lack of the web, which is really the bond that used to keep society together. You know, I read a very interesting article recently that was talking about what it was like in the 60s and the 70s, early 70s in America. And I remember this growing up there. There was this tacit responsibility shared by the American elite, whether that was the heads of organizations, the heads of academic institutions, the heads of union, and the heads of government, all to do what was in, quote, the national interest. So at that point, believe it or not, bipartisanship was common. You know, Republicans voted for Johnson's Great Society. They voted for civil rights, etc., because it was the right thing to do. And that kind of idea that we're here to promote the whole society, not just my own face in the trough, was really the governing principle of the elite. And that is now stopped for really since 1980. Where you had the rise of the lobbying things, you had the lack of regulation, you know, the end of regulation in banking and business, the beginning of real casino banking, the vast disparity between the salaries of rich and poor, of company owners and their staff. You know, it was only a real differential of 40 to 1, you know. The chief exec would get 40 times more than his lowest paid worker in the 70s. That became 400 times to 1,200 times more in the time since the 1980s. So that kind of, that national interest, that sort of patina of glue, the bond that held us all together, that was similar to what really we truly are, what the science shows us we really are, ended at that time. And that's really where we discover, you know, where we began to suffer a real end stage in that competitive individualistic mindset. And that's why we're in the mess we're in.
Yeah, and I'm looking at this, and I've been kind of trying to tune into, you know, where does this resolve? You know, what is it? What is the dynamic involved? And I've been looking at this kind of from the perspective of Dr. Scott Peck in his book World Waiting to Be Reborn, you know, Civility Rediscovered. The rediscovering of civility, you know, I'm wondering whether it's going to be, you know, a process where there's a mass awakening in the unified field, or the field that's surging right now with galactic alignment, you know, the end of the Mayan calendar in terms of our solar system aligning with the galactic plane of hundreds of billions of star systems right now. And there's this surge of light or energy or intelligence that's obviously awakening people to both the problem and, you know, hopefully, you know, before long, the solution. And I'm watching this, you know, this event like Dr. Scott Peck refers to the community building process. And of course, we're talking about global community here, global village. And he says that before real community, any community that's in a community building process, whether it's a religious, spiritual, political, economic community, whatever, that as people are networking together of course, this is the phenomenon with a new social conscience in our social networks and social networking, that the last stage of real community is chaos.
Mm-hmm.
And it,
well, yeah.
That seems like that seems what we're seeing right now is a kind of a chaos, and the powers that be are trying to hold that line on more power, more money for themselves, and they kind of go together. You know, it's like money, power, and who controls the currency of a nation? You know, controls the nation. And,
yes.
And that, so there's this grassroots or net roots phenomena with the internet and with this global village consciousness emerging that is the judgment, you might say, on all that's less than light. And there's an interesting dynamic with going on in the collective conscience right now.
I agree. I think the only thing that I would throw in there is that we all have to recognize that we're the problem too. You know, it's not just them, you know, who are the guys who have who are the 1%, but the 99% too, because we bought into this as well. And
that's right.
We all have that kind of hard wiring right now, or that hard drive now, that's all about individualism and competition, because we've all been brought up in that. It's the engine of our educational model. It's the engine of our relationships. You know, our relationships are highly adversarial. It's the engine of our financial model, of course, our business model. You've got to make a better mousetrap. And it's the engine of even our neighborhoods. You know, God forbid somebody gets a Volvo when or a Mercedes when you're still driving a Volvo. So
yeah.
We all have that very deeply embedded in our consciousness. So part of the idea of evolving, for me, it's not an evolution. It's an embracing of who we really are and wiping this false hard drive clean. And so to me, there are four things, and this is what I really specified in the bond, is in looking for a blueprint about how we should be now, I felt there were four major areas that we needed to start looking at. One was learning to actually see holistically. Because, you know, we've been taught to look at what's in it for me and also to look for things, individual things. And once you are taught to see that way, that's all you can see. When we're children, we're given a book like I was, called Fun with Dick and Jane, you know, and we get focused on the comings and goings of an individual, like, you know, see Dick run. But Easterners don't do that. They have their primers go something like this. They have big brother sitting with little brother. Little brother loves big brother. Big brother looks after little brother. So the first thing they learn about is not the thing and the individual, but the relationship. And that makes for a very different way of viewing the world. I mean, many scientific studies have shown Easterners actually look at detail much more than we do. They see into the space between things. They see the connection that holds things together much more than we do. And so they can see much more. You know, we've got to the point where we can only see our own version of reality. And so one of the things we have to learn is to take a little bit more of what I call aerial perspective, so that we can see multiple levels of reality, because there is where we can see the whole. Now, similarly, we need to change the way we relate to people. Currently, we, again, relate to people in a very adversarial way. It's all about being dominant, being right, winning the debate, using someone for personal gain. All of those are, you know, the basis of so many of our relationships. So we have to learn to change our perspective on that, to be much more about serving as a vehicle of service to that relationship, and working out how you can help somebody else to flourish, because that has a rebound effect upon you too. You flourish as a result too. So there's many things we have to change about how we see, how we relate, how we organize. I think we have to change the way we have communities, in a sense of not changing, you know, neighborhoods with houses, etc., but changing the way we relate to our neighbors too, and reestablishing community in a very connected way. Once again, moving beyond differences by using larger goals. And we have to finally wipe the hard drive clean of what we think we're here to do. Right now, what we're mainly here to do is to make as much money as we can and to figure out in life what's in it for me. So we have to, you know, move beyond that. So I guess my answer to a lot of the people who talk about, you know, consciousness in 2012 and, you know, how we're going to evolve a new consciousness, I think things are changing, but we need to change not only our consciousness, but do a lot of work too. I don't think it's going to happen by us just kind of tapping into certain things. I think we're going to have to work to change, as every civilization has. It doesn't effortlessly comes to a new civilization. We have to work hard to change it.
And I've been looking at this, and you know, we shape our environment, and then our environment shapes us, or we shape our institutions, and then they shape us. Or we shape our, you know, communication processes, and then they shape us. And I've been trying to look at the, you know, where the whole progression of the computer internet revolution, you know, from hardware to software to netware, and you know, we're all, like I said, connected in principle, but we still have the one-way top-down mass-to-mass programming of the collective consciousness with no feedback, you know, consistent with the potential. There's the internet capabilities with social networks of interactive, but it's limited. It's not real time. It's not, you know, of course, mass to mass interaction is what, you know, we see it in terms of demonstrations, but it's more of a win lose thing. It's where we're coming from, it's like the Coliseum spectaculars with, you know, with football games, you know.
Yes.
You know, the one, it's not win win, it's win lose.
Yes, exactly.
And it's so entrenched in our institutions, and I hear you saying, you know, we need to wipe the hard drive clean, and I'm wondering whether the great salvation is going to be some kind of electromagnetic reboot of the Earth and our brains.
I wish we could do something like that. I really do. But failing that kind of a cataclysmic and, you know, revolutionary event, we can go a long way toward changing the way we see the world and changing the way we act in the world. And that was really why I wrote The Bond, was to provide that blueprint, because I think there are certain tools we can use easily that enable us, and I mentioned some of them in The Bond, that enable us to see much wider and to relate in much more of a connected fashion. And there are very simple ways to bring people together beyond, you know, beyond, you know, the kind of complex ideas that we have for, you know, just completely changing all structures. And, you know, one of the things that happens that I pointed to a lot in The Bond is comes from one of the most beloved psychological studies of all time. In the 1950s, a group of 22 12-year-old boys was sent to summer camp, and they were put in two buses. They were encouraged to create their own separate identities. So one created their name. They called themselves the Rattlers, and the other the Eagles. And they were told to live in separate places. They had separate living quarters, and they were engaged in highly competitive games. And watching all of this from their view as camp counselors were a group of psychologists in disguise. And these were in the days before informed consent. And they engineered it so that the games were neck and neck, so the boys were, you know, constantly nearly winning or, you know, really competing against each other. And so the competition grew fierce, and before long, nobody had to engineer anything. The boys were killing each other. They were beating each other up. They were stealing each other's flags. They were invading each other's living quarters. It was unbelievable. They hated each other. They refused to even eat with each other. So then the psychologists created a series of crises in the camp that could only be sorted by the collective efforts of everyone involved. So they put an impediment in the water supply, and the boys had to all work together to get it out. They put a truck in a ditch, and the boys had to work together to get it out. And before long, miracles happened. The boys began sitting together. They began eating together and befriending each other. And by the end of the camp, they unanimously voted to ride on the same bus together. And one of the leaders of one of the groups spent all of his prize money buying ice creams for the whole lot. Now, that coming together for a larger goal, it's called a superordinate goal. And there's a really simple reason for why it works so well in overcoming prejudice and division and bringing people together. When people do things for a common goal, everybody's brainwaves start operating in synchrony. So we become like one giant superorganism. And they also have found in studies of the Oxford University rowing team that when the team rows together, everybody has a higher pain threshold than when they row individually. So rowing together raises everybody's game. So all of these things are, I think, evident that one of the simple ways to start bringing people together is just what's happening now, which is crisis. And what the politicians aren't getting, because they can't even speak to each other across the aisle, much less do anything bipartisan, is that we are in crisis and that we have to stop being political for a while and do things together. But my view is that it isn't going to happen from top down. It's going to happen from bottom up, which is, again, why I wrote The Bond, is that it starts with people, small groups, coming together for a larger goal and inviting other members of the community in and starting to work on something together. And that becomes the cohesive glue to forge the new society.
Now, I've been looking at this from trying to look at it from a practical perspective with three holistic health clinics that I've had over the years. And I worked with electrodiagnostics, really quantum field, some of the pioneering equipment, and some of the one of the individuals that really pioneered quantum field diagnostics. And this was in my third clinic, and I saw what happens in the quantum field, of course, of the individual, the auric field, and pretesting the effects of nutritionals and homeopathics, you know, in the energy fields of the body, and going on to seeing just amazing things which go on, you know, in the thought processes of the individual and the environment around them, you know, where they're coming from, and how it's, you know, the core of the physical goes back to, you know, emotional, mental, and really is you know, the spirit, a spirit or I sometimes refer to it as the source field, the source of all their problems. And I saw the kind of phenomena there that I tried to apply then to interactive mass communications with an interface that would make possible mass-to-mass communications, so that it would involve and evolve our individual and collective conscience, not just, you know, we involve our consciousness, but the effect of this with a community building process, mm-hmm. with a communication process, is that you a culturing of conscience, you know, like a unified field, or, you know, your book on the field, you know, really kind of tuned me into that. You're really talking about the same thing in a different way. And as I look at this, you know, I realize that the technology of communications itself has got to the same point where it's right on the threshold of the potential of social conscience in our social networks, you know, the social networking phenomena. And again, there's this thing of there's a right before the last stage of real community, there's chaos, there's this cognitive dissonance with the old paradigm, the old mindset, you know, the old hard drive records are still running. And it's like the ego will do anything for self-preservation of itself in the face of the end of the world as it's known it.
Yes.
And I think that's kind of where we're at. You know, I've tuned into the people talking about the Mayan calendar. They're not saying it's the end of the world. They're saying it's the end of the world as we've known it. You know, our perception,
yes,
of time, space will be totally different.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, we have to also throw in with that, you know, the idea that we've got 49 years, not even that. I think we've got 39 years of oil left. You know,
yeah,
that's according to some views. Now, that will change the end of, that will make the end of the world as we know it, because oil is really at the key to our modern technological world. So that will change everything, too. So all of these things maybe were prefigured. And it is, as you say, there's all this chaos before new self-organization. And so I think what we have is several scenarios. You know, we can descend into terrible chaos, as I said earlier, or we can make this a conscious process.
Yeah, and make conscious choices of utilizing all these breakthroughs in free energy technology that are out there. I remember working with Stanley Meyer back in Ohio 20 years ago, through friends that, you know, we had developed, you know, the hydrogen fuel cell and the hydrogen conversion on a demand basis and cars that ran all the way across the the country on water. But there's all this technology regarding the quantum field and energy from space, that just, you know, free energy devices to run homes and industry, but it makes all the infrastructure of power lines and power plants and power's owner, you know, the ownership and control of power, with a meter on it, you know, it's if it's free energy and people are off the grid and independent, you know, and you can't charge them, then it gets back to the ownership and control paradigm of the top-down, you know, command and control system that we have. And I mean, it's not that we haven't got technological solutions to energy that exist now. It's just that it creates disruption in the status quo.
Yes, exactly. Absolutely. And, you know, and the interesting thing about the Occupy movement, which will only grow and which has the support of, you know, half of Americans and growing, you know, it's making the Tea Party look like a Tea Party, you know, compared to what's going on, the real mood here of change. What's interesting about that is that that can force what has always been, you know, we've had the few at the top forcing the many to take this kind of system in, you know, our energy, et cetera, et cetera. And so many systems being blocked, so much innovation in this area being blocked or marginalized because of the people in charge and money, you know, oil money, et cetera, et cetera. So what's interesting about this movement is that it will more and more bring this process, this corrupt process, to light, shine a light on it, so that it no longer becomes viable.
Yeah. Well, I'm very hopeful that that is going to reach critical mass sooner than later. I actually gave up practicing holistic medicine with the clinics because every community that, you know, I really came right out with, you know, an alternative, it was amazing how the resentment and revenge of doctors who practice, you know, drugs per symptom medicine would come out of the woodwork and organize to just make either life hell for me or just flat out put me out of business.
I know, it's kind of scary. I mean, I've been in writing about health too for now 21 years with What Doctors Don't Tell You, so I know exactly what you're talking about. There is, you know, a huge vested interest. One of the largest businesses in the world is the pharmaceutical industry. And, you know, they're not going to go quietly, basically.
Yeah, there's no question about
that. But there is this huge groundswell. There is this huge, huge groundswell now. And so I think that we're going to see that lesser and less of an ability to push from a top-down method, a lot of these ideas and a lot of these practices on people, I think it will move, it will change, because, you know, people are now, they've seen it, they've seen, you know, they've seen the emperor behind the iron curtain, you know, or behind the curtain. They've seen that this is all a fake and a corrupt model, and so they're wanting and they're demanding a change. So I think that there will be much more honest dialogue about this.
Well, I see more open discussion, and I try to keep my finger on the pulse of a lot of internet news groups that I think are kind of ones that I consider archetypal for these different medical management, media, marketing, megatrend models, you might say. And mm-hmm. and I try to keep my finger on the pulse, and I can see, of course, with medicine, there's more of this awakening to the paradigm shift from the chemistry of disease to the energies of health. And we're seeing it, you know, more and more stuff coming out on free energy technologies that have been suppressed or bought off, and other people pick up the baton and run with it, and different alternatives are coming out in all of our social, political, and economic institutions. You know, where the status quo is trying to hold the line, there are end runs going on.
Yes, exactly. And, you know, what's very interesting, and that was one of the things that I found so interesting in researching the material for The Bond. I mean, the first part of my book, I really look at the new frontier science, the new story of who we are, and the science coming to the fore in so many different areas is supporting this whole idea that we are one indivisible whole. We're one giant intergalactic superorganism. And when you see between the subatomic information that's now coming to the fore, which demonstrates that, you know, there isn't even such a thing as a subatomic thing, because a subatomic particle isn't a thing at all. It's a trade of energy and information with other subatomic particles. And so, in a sense, it's not a thing, it's a relationship. And they find that that unit, you know, that basic unit of the universe is mimicked all through nature. And we're now finding, you know, scientists are realizing that, you know, we are not, that our genes are only like the keys of a piano. They get played or not according to environmental influences, the water we drink, the air we breathe, the food we eat, the friends we have, the sum total of, you know, how we live our lives. And so our creation, our own individual creation, is not as a self-contained entity, but as a dynamic bond with our environment. We get created, in a sense, from outside in, from the environmental impact on our genetic material.
And from the inside out.
Not from the inside out. We get created from the outside in. We get created because of the bond with our environment. You know, our genes are just there, like keys of a piano, waiting to be played.
I see what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking about the source field, or the energy field, the unified field of the fabric of space time. Called the Antakarana in the East, you know, the web of light, that mm-hmm. there's this web of energy that resonates with the DNA, and is like, which is like a tuning fork, and that energy apparently is, I don't know if you've seen the YouTube videos by David Wilcox on the source field investigations, but that energy surges every 25,800 years, you know, when with the precession of the equinox, when our solar system crosses the galactic plane, and it's in alignment with the hundreds of billions of star systems in the galactic plane, that surging of that photonic light, or that the intelligence in that light of universe, you know, the order of the universe, somehow reboots and accelerates all the change, you know, change on, of evolution, of biology. It accelerates, you know, consciousness, the rise of civilizations, And the last time, you know, that our solar system crossed the galactic plane in its orbit, up and across, the Great Crossing, as the Mayan call it, across the galactic plane, was about 14,000 years ago, the time of Atlantis. In other words, that's what I meant from the inside out. There's an energy. But again, it is from the outer to the inner.
Yeah, think of the field. Think of the field as the all-encompassing web. And we are just, we're a little knot in that field, you know, and that's really it. And we are, you know, it's affected within us and all through from our subatomic particles out. But really it starts from out and we are, you know, just a part of that, really, just a little corner of that web. So scientists are starting to realize this in so many different areas. The work on solar activity, you know, you were talking about, you know, certain effects and polar effects, et cetera. Well, you know, science, and this is mainstream science, not astrology, not woo-woo stuff. You know, scientists at the University of Minnesota and elsewhere have been doing a lot of work on the effect of solar activity on living things, particularly human beings. And they've known for a long time that solar activity, and by that I mean solar flares and all the gaseous stuff that giant ball of hydrogen and unstable magnetic fields hurls towards Earth. And they found that, you know, and we know, we've long known that that affects the human heart and the brain, the two major electrical engines of the body. But we now, you know, so that heart attacks increase and psychiatric admissions increase when there's a lot of solar activity and epileptic fits increase. But we now know that it also affects our behavior and, you know, terrorist activity, stock market activity, you know, even the solicitation efforts of Jehovah's Witnesses, which they've studied because they had a lot of data they got as a little windfall, all seem to track perfectly solar activity. So
amazing.
That really, you know, begs the question, how can we say with any finality that we are the captains of our own fate? You know, we can't really, because we exist as an intergalactic superorganism, and we can only see ourselves and understand ourselves truly when we see that absolute and total influence of one on the other.
Yeah. And how the individual frames the whole. It's like I've looked at this healing process from a lot of different angles, and I've come around to only the whole can be made whole. You must somehow conceive it, believe it, and achieve wholeness conceive and believe it to achieve it. And of course, you know, in the healing process, the first stage I found with a client is to bring them out of denial that they've got a problem, or the scope of the problem, and what wholeness or healing, what process would look like, you know. For them to make a choice, because I always keyed it or brought it around to informed choice, everyone's 100% right for their prevailing awareness. They may be out to lunch as far as cosmic law or universal law or, you know, healing laws needed. And, of course, to somehow marry the individual's frame of reference on the whole, the holy whole, I always found that that's... Not just for the individual, but, you know, to answer this SOS to save our society. Somehow there's got to be an awareness of what wholeness would look like, you know, where we're going as a goal, and to step into that circle of wholeness and to somehow embrace the process that'll make it so.
Well, as I say, I hoped that my book, The Bond, will be a first blueprint to that, because what I tried to do in the book was to provide a new story of who we are, because the story we've had is that we were born to be selfish. We are individuals. You know, that's been at the very basis of all of our thinking. And from that basis, we've built all of our societal structures. So in order to wipe that view clean, you have to come up with a different worldview. And the worldview that is really coming to the fore is that we are so tightly interconnected that we can't conceive of ourselves as individual. We have to see ourselves as a giant intergalactic superorganism, a bond. And from there, I think you can see and start modeling what that's going to look like. Now, I mentioned that I talked about changing the way we relate, changing the way we perceive things, looking for a larger definition of who we are so that we can easily cross divides and work together for larger goals and start seeing that we're all working for the same goal. And finally, we really need to change our life's purpose and change what we think we're here to do. It's got to be something beyond just what's in it for me. But with that, I think we also have to empower ourselves with the understanding that we can change things. You know, people just think, well, what can I do? Everything's so overwhelming. What a mess. Foreign debt crisis, double dip recession, ecological crisis, you know, extreme weather crisis. What can I do? And to that, I just say, let me tell you the story of Marie and the Coke machine. Marie was in an office, a typical dog-eat-dog, every-man-for-himself type company, and she got tired of it, and she wondered what she could do, one little person could do. So she decided, every time she got her Coke in the afternoon, to leave change there and leave a little sign that said, "Your Coke has been paid for. Keep the spirit alive and pay it forward." Well, this completely freaked out her company. They started creating a spy network around the Coke machine to find out who the Secret Santa was. So Marie moved her operations to the floor above and started leaving donuts there every day with the same little sign. Donuts have been left here, keep the spirit alive, etc. This becomes the dinner table conversation of all of the employees for weeks. And ultimately, it becomes the driving force that completely changes the model of that office. Because what it did is it held a little mirror up to everybody and said, this is who you really are. You know, and when generosity is the currency, the game starts changing very, very rapidly because it appeals to who we really are. We're all hardwired to share, care, and be fair. We have hardwiring in the brain that makes us, you know, want to be fair. And we have an it's not fair button in the brain that goes off when we're given too little or we take too much. And we have needs, a need to give altruistically that's as powerful as our need to eat and have sex. All of these things happen. So when we really have an experience of generosity, that changes everything. And even the scientists have said, in a culture where turn-taking has fallen apart, where we are right now, all it takes are a few people wedded to strong reciprocity. That means turn-taking, giving and taking, to change the whole culture around.
Well, I think you've really said it with this example of the currency of conscience is what I call it. Yeah, it's like a new currency that's emerging, and that's a good example. You have many extraordinary examples in your book that really make the case of what I would call the currency of conscience, an all-connected bond, you know, with that it has a currency to it, and that's the currency where I see a lot of great hope. And we're going to have to do a wrap, but Lynn, I want to thank you so much for being on the show. It was it's wonderful to hear your voice and your story of the bond. Your other books have that same inspired perspective of so much more that we all, I think, know in our heart of hearts. And I don't mean to oversimplify it with the currency of conscience, but I see the same resolution of our core problems in that regard. So thank you so much for being on Cosmic Love.
It's been lovely being with you, Chris, and thank you so much. And I love that phrase you've got. I just wanted to let people know, too, if they want to connect further and find out more about the bond, our fairness campaign, and how to set up bond groups and become bonded in your relationships and your communities, please come on to
www.thebond.net.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lynn. God bless you.
Thank you. You too. Take good care.
Bye-bye. Bye. So that's a wrap for this week. Look forward to seeing everyone here in a couple weeks. Happy trails until we meet again. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this presentation on Cosmic Love. I hope you have enjoyed receiving this as much as I have enjoyed giving it. There is a new relationship with all humanity that is maturing with the new synchronicity of instant, everywhere, interactive, net reality. Cosmic Love is the heart of this synchronicity. Tools and processes that empower the wisdom of Cosmic Love is the purpose of the Worldwide Love Foundation. The family of man is now making a quantum leap into a new consciousness as never before in history. Our awareness as humankind is expanding, and the internet reflects that multidimensional expansion of consciousness into new realms of omniscience, omnipresence, and omnipotence in the power of cosmic love. This has huge implications. The more information we have, the greater the need to get it all in order. The more knowledge power we have, the greater the need for the wisdom of cosmic love. That should be common sense, and it's time to make common sense more common. If you agree that the American Revolution was huge for freedom and opportunity in the world, look what's happening to the whole world now. A new connection with cosmic love is positioning the golden rule, law, language for a golden age in our spirit, our minds, our hearts, and the soul of humanity. We're on the threshold of a global revolution that is awakening the angels of our better nature. Let's be honest and reason together. Cosmic love has always been the golden rule law language for every golden age in cosmic history. Some things don't change, only the ability of the human mind to grasp the full implications of the world in which we now live. That has changed with the internet, and like an adolescent who is not an adult yet, but not a child either, the internet is now installed, operational, and ready to take our personal and planetary consciousness to the next level. That would be cosmic love, and the foundation principles for this is the love model, a universal law language interface for net reality that represents the five-dimensional intelligence that can fulfill a global revolution in higher consciousness. Check it out for yourself. See how it works. Consider the role you can play and how you can benefit. The sooner you get the vision of this cosmic love thing, the sooner you can profit from a wholly new economy that will transform all our social networks with extraordinary abundance of everything held sacred by free people worldwide. There is a new intelligence that is defining and refining humanity's evolutionary ascent. The higher the intelligence of universal cosmic love, the greater the results. The gateway to higher consciousness is, in fact, the language of consciousness. The five-dimensional intelligence that cosmic love frames in form and frequency, as in frequently. Once you get it, how the Holy Spirit of love and action can heal our individual and collective conscience, it will become self-evident how cosmic love can nurture and culture the net reality that brings a Holy Spirit to the collective consciousness of humanity. Love heals all, always has, always will. The more cosmic and universal the vision of love, the greater the results. Welcome to the opportunity. It's time to link the light workers who are love makers. The internet now provides this opportunity for extraordinary synchronicity, as will empower wisdom with cosmic love. Someone had to do it. Now you can. Network for the net worth of this new net reality. You have the vision now before you. What you do with it can change your world and the world at large. We are all co-creators in the cosmic scheme of cosmic love. The great spirit of great love is the great opportunity that genuine freedom gives all of us. Heaven knows that there is nothing more valuable than the vision of cosmic love that has found its time. Experience the Worldwide Love Foundation in your consciousness, being, and world. care enough to share this vision of great opportunity. Step into the circle of global connection as you center and connect with the five-dimensional intelligence of cosmic love that provides the cultural DNA for a golden age on Earth. Miracles happen when cosmic love is conceived, believed, and achieved. You are that miracle when you become the cosmic love you want to see in the world. Own this vision as your own. Embrace the intrinsic virtue of cosmic love. Make the vow to do what you can because you can. Claim the victory for all mankind aspiring to live as kind men. Here's to winning from the beginning of a global revolution that will finish worldwide with the great experiment and representative government gave humanity with the American Revolution. Heaven on earth is virtually in your hands. Do you want the keys to the kingdom? Are you ready to assemble the components to the capstone of cosmic love vision? Discover the five-dimensional intelligence that will empower your own virtually untapped gifts and talents. Consider how you can make a difference, if not the difference. It's your life, your world. Take command. Give cosmic love the chance that you want for all mankind. Now you can. See for yourself. Do it for cosmic love, and heaven knows cosmic love will bless your life far beyond this one. Sooner or later, what goes around comes around. You can call that good karma, or the justice of cosmic law, or just the blessings of cosmic love. It's the same thing. The abundant life is born in abundant love. The more cosmic that love, the more abundant is your life. Personally, now, I can't think of anything better to do, and I hope you feel the same way. So keep in touch with cosmic love. It only gets better as you pay attention. This is how cosmic love works. Pay attention because attention pays in ways that make cosmic love the new currency for global peace and prosperity. Your attention is your consciousness. The next economy for planetary civilization will pay attention to the value of virtue, the virtue of cosmic love. The family of man and our global village must be connected to this one virtue. We must pay attention to the first principles of higher consciousness if we are to transcend the old paradigms of scarcity consciousness that scarcity economics has created. This is the whole point of cosmic love. We won't heal our personal and planetary problems with the same consciousness that created the problems. The best hope for humanity is the charity of goodwill among mankind. This is the charity of cosmic love in action. This is the Holy Spirit of cosmic love in man that raises mankind with loving kindness. I hope you appreciate this message and share it with others. That may be just your circle of influence with family and friends, or it may be every news group or blog on the internet where lightworkers and enlightened netizens, global citizens, hang out. By the grace of cosmic love, enough good people will do enough soon enough to quickly turn the tide of global consciousness from the paradigm of scarcity to the paradigm of abundance that cosmic love cultures. May the quickening and awakening of consciousness begin with you and your own personal evolution in higher consciousness. Thanks again for listening to Cosmic Love.